The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
First of all, thank you so much for joining me. It's definitely been a very challenging couple of weeks. I anticipate it will continue to be challenging. This class is in honor of my mother, Liba Bat Hodel and Shlomo. And I just want to start off with just a few words about my mother. But really the theme of tonight or this afternoon's talk, life after death, has two meanings. It's my life after her death, or any mourner's life after the death of their beloved, as well as the life after death of the deceased. And just a few words in honor of my mother. My mother was truly a Yiddish mama in every sense of the word. I'm sorry that there seems to be such a dwindling of Yiddish mamas. I don't know how many more years we have in this generation to really know Yiddish mamas from the Alta Haim, from the old country, the Polish, Russian Jew. My mother was born in Vilna, and she was taken to the concentration camp when she was 15 years old. And my mother never talked about her experience in the concentration camp because she did not want my sister or I to have to hear the horrors of what she went through. It turns out that my mother did a tape with the Shoah Foundation, which she didn't tell us about. We only happened to find this tape. And I was never able to see this tape until yesterday. We found the tape, and we were finally able to see it. And my mother, on the tape, near the end, when she was asked, "Why did you decide to do this interview?" she said, "I have always hidden from my children what I went through, but I now feel that my grandchildren have to know what happened to the Jewish people." So my mother was a silent sufferer. It's not an uncommon phenomenon amongst Holocaust survivors. Some do talk, but some don't. And that silence of my mother, in a certain way, played into, I guess, my imagination, because then I kind of imagine what must have happened to my mother in the camps, and being only a 15-year-old girl, and losing your mother, your father, two other siblings. My mother describes in the tape how when the Nazis rounded them up, they put them in a lineup, and her mother was told to go left, and my mother was told to go right. And that was the last time she ever saw her mother. It was just the point of a finger of a Nazi, you go left and you go right. So I dedicate this class to my mother because I dedicate much of my life to my mother and my father. He should live to 120, should have a lot of health and a lot of nachas. Who I am ties very much into the Holocaust. At a very young age, I struggled to understand what kind of God did this to my grandparents, did this to my mother, did this to my aunts and uncles who I never met, to the Jewish people. Why is there so much suffering in the world? I thought about life after death. I thought about reincarnation as a child. I thought that perhaps I am the reincarnation of my mother's brother. These were ideas that hit me at a very young age, and I struggled with at a very young age. And at a very young age, I was a philosopher. And looking back at it all now with the books that Hashem has blessed me to participate in producing, It's just the line is so clear, how I've been in search of a God of love and in search of a life of meaning, and I share that with anyone who needs to hear that. I always say that I didn't write these books for anybody. I didn't research this in material to write books. This has all been my journey in search of answers to my questions. And I'm pretty satisfied with the answers that I got, although thank God I've got more questions, which will be a catalyst to discover, hopefully for myself, and maybe share with others more answers. So the journey goes on. But I want to talk about death. And the Midrash, oral tradition, has a very shocking statement. In the beginning of the Torah, when it describes creation, when we get to the sixth day, every day it says that God saw what he had done and it was good. But on the sixth day, which is the culmination of creation, it says that God looked at what he had created and it was very good. And Rabbi Meir, in the oral tradition, the Midrash, he comments on the very good to refer to death. And that what was very good about the world was the possibility of death. And that's a shocking idea. What is very good about death? And So I want you to stand there. There's a Hasidic story about a Rebbe who's on his deathbed, and his wife begins to cry, and the Rebbe turns to her and he says, "Please, please don't cry. My whole life has been in preparation for this moment. I ask you to be really careful with what I'm about to share." They say a story about a fellow who became a heretic, and they asked him, "Why did you become a heretic, a disbeliever in Judaism?" He said, "Because he read the commentary of the Abarbanel," which was really quite bizarre. How is that possible? The Abarbanel was a brilliant commentary in the Torah. Well, as it turns out, the commentary of the Abarbanel, he likes to start off his writings with, like, questions, but tons of questions, 20, 30 questions, and then he begins to answer all those questions. Well, as it turns out, this particular fellow, he would read the questions, but he fell asleep before he got to the answers, and therefore he only got the questions of the Abarbanel, but never read the answers. So, not that I'm going to start with a bunch of questions, but what I'm going to share is a perspective on death that is just extraordinarily positive. So much so that the ultimate question we'll have to ask after this is, so if it's so great, why not do it now, right? And so just if you don't hang on to the end of this, just know that the punchline you have missed, as much as I'm going to start off with the positive side, the very good that death is. There's a reason why we're in this world, and there's a huge very good to this world too. What happens when a person dies? God granted me and my sister the opportunity to be with my mother till her very last breath. In fact, we were not anticipating my mother dying. We had still hope that we'd beat her illness. And surely we did not think it would be so sudden. But essentially what happened was I was in Toronto, and my sister was, I was with my mother and father, and then my sister was coming, and the goal was basically to be flying back and forth between Israel and Toronto and changing off between my sister and I. My sister arrived on a Monday morning, and I was flying out that Monday night, and that was the day my mother died, almost as if she didn't want to cause us any bother if I would go on a plane, come back 3 days later. It was a very bizarre, and my mother went into a coma. The doctor came and he told us that he thinks she's dying, and of course I was not going to get on a plane. And my sister and I sat by my mother's side for about 5 hours as she took very deep breaths. She was in a tremendous state of calm and peace, and we were there in her very last moment. And quite frankly, I thought I was watching someone give birth. It reminded me of birth. Thank God I've been present at the 7 births of my children. And that deep breathing of a woman who is about to give birth, I felt that my mother was giving birth to herself into a new world. And they say a story about a father who had lost a son, and surely anyone losing their son or any beloved is devastated, and many tried to console him and were unsuccessful. He then went to the great tzaddik, Rav Aryeh Levin, and Rav Aryeh Levin says, you know, what do we know, what do we know? When a baby's born, the baby cries, but the parents say mazel tov. What do we know? When the soul leaves this world, we cry, but the souls in the next world and the angels in the next world, they joyously say mazel tov. Of course, as much as I didn't want to see my mother go, and as much as at this very moment as I speak, I'm struggling to hold back tears, even though it probably doesn't sound that way in my voice, I felt I saw my mother give birth to herself. And when I was at the burial, which was very shocking to me, because as a Kohen, we don't go to burials, only of a relative, a mother and father, actually, am I allowed to go into a cemetery close to another grave. You can go into a cemetery, you just can't be close to a grave. But in the case of burying your mother and father, then you can go into the grave. And so this was actually the first time I ever in my life actually saw a burial. And saw that hole and participated in lowering my mother's body into the ground. And as that body went into the ground, what flashed before my eyes was my mother dancing. And I really believe she is dancing. Even though I continue to cry. In Jewish tradition, when we cry over someone passing away, we're not crying about them. We're not saying, oy vey, if only they could have had a longer life. Oy vey, if only they could have seen their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren. That's not at all what we are saying. That is not at all why we are crying. And someone who cries because of that has a completely distorted understanding of this world, the next world, and what death is really all about and why we're here in this world in the first place. When we cry over the deceased of anyone, we're crying because we miss them. Because they're no longer in our world, but we are still in their world. And I want to try and understand how that's possible. Essentially, when someone dies, they are going to a different world. Now, when we say a different world, we're not talking about planets, right? We're not imagining, you know, different balls, you know, and people are jumping onto some different planet. To understand another world, let's just explore a little bit what this world is. According to Kabbalah, this world is a perception. It's not an illusion. It's a perception. There's reality. But we are viewing reality with only our 5 senses, which is very limiting. In fact, one of my teachers described it as a person looking into a palace through 5 keyholes. How much of the palace could you see? Right? The world that you're seeing right this very second before you is an extremely narrow slice of reality. And what it looks like because of the data processing of your 5 senses. Okay? Imagine a person who was born blind. They're not in your world. Right? They might stand beside you, but they're in a very different world because they have a very different perception. Okay? Imagine a person who is blind and deaf. They're in a very different world. Right? Now, imagine a person who is blind and has no clue what colors are, what shapes look like, and suddenly we gave them sight. They would be in a new world. When a person dies, they are actually going to a whole new level of consciousness whereby now they perceive the world with greater senses than we do. That's why in Jewish tradition, this world is actually described as the world of falsity, of illusion. Olam de shikra. It's a sheker. There's a certain lie, a distortion that we are subject to because of the limitation of our ability to perceive. But the world that one goes to when they die is referred to as Olam HaEmes. It's the world of truth. The world of truth because they now have greater access to seeing reality as it really is. It says in the Torah that when Yaakov Avinu, Jacob our father, was on his way to see Yosef his son in Egypt, God announces to Yaakov, Yaakov, don't worry, Yosef will close your eyes. The Zohar on this very verse, the Zohar is part of the mystical tradition of Judaism, the Kabbalah, it asks, why do you have to close the eyes of the deceased? And the Zohar says, because the shapes and the colors of this world are in our eyes. And therefore, to allow the deceased, so to speak, to see a new world, we have to close their eyes to this world and thereby opening up a whole new inner eye to seeing reality in a much broader, more honest, more genuine way. And I was blessed that I was able to close my mother's eyes. When a person dies, it's very common that their eyes open up, and I closed my mother's eyes. And I blessed her that she now has the nachas to see the world from a greater perspective, and that she could finally get the answers to her questions that I know she struggled with her whole life. Where was God in the Holocaust? And I'm sure she's got her answer. You know, you got to be very careful. Sometimes we ask too many questions. They say a story about a fellow who asked a lot of questions of God, and God says, okay, if you want answers, come on up. Okay? We'll get the answers. But if you ask too many questions and you're too anxious to get the answers are in the next world. They're not all in this world. Most of them are in my books, actually, just joking. But they're not all in this world. So when a person dies, what's actually happening is they're not dying, but rather they're expanding into a whole new level of consciousness whereby their perceptions, they are no longer functioning from the level of five senses. They've plugged into, or they have accessed, the ability to perceive reality with much more senses than we have. And it's kind of like the difference between a human being and an insect. Now, I don't know, I haven't interviewed many insects, but how does the insect view the world? Is the insect seeing the world the way you see the world? Maybe not. Does a dog see the world as we see the world? Maybe its senses takes the raw data that it meets and translates it into the hard drive of his mind, and he gets his picture of reality, and I have a very different picture of reality. He's in my world, that dog is in my world, because my senses include his world, but I'm not in his world, possibly, or what he sees, he doesn't see what I see. I see what he sees, but he doesn't see what I see. And that's a fabulous and very exciting idea that although, my mother's not in my world, I'm in her world. And although I miss her, she doesn't miss me. In fact, she gets me on an even deeper level than she ever was able to get in her life. This is what Rav Kook explains based on the Kabbalah. Rav Kook explains in his classic Orot HaKodesh, The Lights of Holiness, in volume 2, page 380. He says, "A mavet hu chizyon shav. Death is a vain, a worthless, shav means a worthless vision. Tumato, its impurity, is its lie. When we talk in Jewish tradition that death has impurity, the impurity of the death is that the death is giving off a deceptive message, right? We think it's the end, and that's a lie. But we've bought into the lie, and we see this. It seems clear. Masha b'nei adam karim mavet, that which we human beings refer to and describe as death, is actually a influx and intensification of life and its actualization. Do you get this? This is really amazing. What happens when a person dies is there's this incredible influx of life force, and there's an actualization, so much so that the soul literally jumps out of the body. The soul, according to Kabbalah, doesn't want to be here. The soul yearns to be connected at consciously and clearly to its source. The soul comes from Ein Sof, from the unlimited, from the divine, from God, and that's all the soul yearns for. However, God, so to speak, infused into this world sparks of His presence. So much so that it keeps us here. We say, well, okay, it's not so bad. But if the soul were to really know what it's about to reveal and what it's about to perceive after death, it would leave right away, right? But we're here for a purpose on earth, and we're not trying to we're not into leaving faster than we can, because there's a great benefit to this world, but it is hard for the soul that came from endlessness to be trapped in the world where you keep bumping into borders and boundaries, and it's hard for the soul. And because, he explains, we have fallen into the smallness of mind that the inclination of man has sunk us into, so to speak, we are imagining this intensification of life, he explains, in a dark and dreary vision. And we call that death. Right? And the truth is that Kohanim, and I myself amongst them, they're not allowed to be around death. Because they have to be teachers, they have to be models of inspiration, and therefore they have to be especially careful not to see death, not to be around death, because our message as Kohanim is about life. And death, in the meantime, in our world, from our perspective, is giving off a very distorted and very misleading message about who we are and where we're going. So what happens when a person dies is a form of birthing, but to a higher self. And it's not as if it's not painful. In fact, what was shocking as I was there watching my mother as she took these deep breaths and let them out like a woman with every contraction, it was really quite consistent for 5 hours, but then you could tell the breath was getting more shallow. And then suddenly, my mother suddenly made a face, a totally new face. It was a little cringe. It was as if someone put a little sour candy in her mouth, and I actually thought she was about to wake up from her coma, and I was right. I was right. She did wake up, but not in my world. She woke up to a whole new world. When I shared this with my children, my son told me that this is exactly what's described in the Gemara. The Talmud says that the angel of death stands over the deceased, and just before they leave this world, the angel of death puts a little drop of bitterness in their mouth. I literally saw this. I literally saw like a little sour candy. My mother suddenly had this little sour face, and then she was gone into a whole state of complete peace. And obviously, my heart is shattered, crushed. I've had a roller coaster of emotions since my mother's passed away. But it's not because I feel bad about her. It's not when I watch my children, and thank God we just had a granddaughter, and my daughter called her Ashira Liba. And, you know, I don't cry, oh, if only my mother could see her great-granddaughter. My mother is seeing her great-granddaughter. She is seeing a great-granddaughter, and she's getting the incredible nachas to know that her great-granddaughter is named after her. In fact, my father said, but he should live to 120, I'm jealous of your mother. She's already in a better world, and she already has, you know, she already has a great-granddaughter named after her. But I pray my father not be too jealous, and we keep in this world as long as we can. So why do we want to stay in this world if the next world is Tov Me'od? If death is a transition into a higher perception, whereby we have access to reality in a much more accurate way of what's really going on, in contrast to the little slice of life that we're seeing right now, so why not, you know, why not drink the Kool-Aid now, right? And the answer is, there's an incredible piece in Pirkei Avot that explains, this is Pirkei Avot chapter 4. Pirkei Avot explains that this world is a hallway and the next world is the palace. Prepare yourself in the hallway in order to enter into the palace. But this is the hallway. We've made a mistake. People think this is the palace because it's so beautiful, right? I mean, it's just so, sometimes. I mean, but, you know, you can't not be awe-inspired when you see flowers. And now, Baruch Hashem, in Eretz Yisrael, spring and the flowers coming up are just overwhelmingly inspirational. I mean, it's just like mind-boggling. And if this is what the hallway looks like, imagine what the palace is going to look like. But it continues in this Pirkei Avot in Mishnah 17, chapter 4. It says that Rabbi Yaakov would explain that 1 hour of tshuva and good deeds in this world is worth the entirety of the life of the next world. But beautiful is 1 hour of peace, inner peace, tranquility in the next world than all of this world. There's an advantage to this world and a disadvantage, and there's an advantage to the next world and a disadvantage. The advantage of the next world is you're going to get all the answers. The after-death world. The advantage of the next world is you will rest in peace. The advantage of the next world is that you'll get the bigger picture. You'll get the whole truth and nothing but the truth. You know, when you go to court and they say, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, what does that mean? Why not just say, I swear to tell the truth? Well, because the truth isn't necessarily the whole truth. If my son comes home and says, Yossi hit me, so that's true, Yossi did hit him. I, of course, conclude that Yossi is a terrible kid, and I rush out to talk to this kid, Yossi. And when I go to Yossi, I say, Yossi, you hit my son? He says, yes. How could you do that? He says, what do you mean, how could I do that? Your son kicked me. Oh, I'm sorry, Yossi. My son didn't lie. He told me the truth. Yossi did kick him. Yossi did hit him, but he didn't tell me that he kicked him first. So I go, oh, I can't believe it. And I run back to my son and say, how could you do this to Yossi? How could you kick Yossi? What do you mean, how could I kick Yossi? Did Yossi tell you that he first punched me? Oh, right? Everyone's telling the truth, but not the whole truth. This world is the truth, but it's not the whole truth. And because it's not the whole truth, there's a lie to it. There's a deception to it. But it's that very deception, that very lack of clarity, that doubtfulness that we are thrown into, which is why we have free choice in the first place. In the next world, it'll be obvious. Just like in this world, nobody really has free choice to put their hand into fire. It's obvious. You won't put your hand in fire because you know exactly what happens. So there's no mystery here. A child will, but once you taste it one time, you're not going to intentionally put your finger into fire. You don't have a choice in that, really. I mean, you do, but you really don't. It's too obvious to you. In this world, we're able to do mitzvahs because there are lack of clarity. In the next world, it'll be obvious to do mitzvahs. So we won't have a choice in the matter, right? It'll be obvious to do mitzvahs. That's why there's a story about a Roman who goes to one of the rabbis in the Midrash and says to him, he says, "What's so special about, you know, the Jewish people?" So he says, well, this was a nobleman. So he says, "What's so special about you?" He says, "Well, the king has honored me." You know, so he said, "Well, so the king has honored us, right? The king of the universe." He says, "I don't accept that." So he said, "Oh no, I'm sorry." He says, "What's so special about Shabbos?" So he says, "Well, the king has honored the Shabbos." He said, "I don't accept that." So he says, "Tell me what's so special about Shabbos." He said, "Well, there's a famous river called the Sambatyon River, and that river rests on Shabbat." So what? He says, "Yes, during the week, the current takes up the rocks or the pebbles on the bottom, the bed of the river, and carries it in its flow. But on Shabbat, it rests and it doesn't, and the rocks don't get carried in the flow." He says, "That's ridiculous. I don't believe that." All right. So he said, "Give me, I need proof. What's special about Shabbos?" So he says, "Okay, you know what? The best thing is we'll just talk to your dad." Talk to my dad. The Roman says, "My dad is dead." So he says, "I know your dad is dead, and I know that you frequently make contact with him through seances, right? But you've never tried to call him on a Shabbos." "He won't answer on Shabbos." He said, "That's ridiculous." He says, "I'm telling you, he won't answer on Shabbos." Okay, so the guy says, "All right, I'm going to put in a call through a seance to conjure up my father from the other world, and he can't. Friday night, he can't get him. He's not responding. All week long, he's responded. He can't get him. Motzi Shabbos, the night after the Sabbath, he shows up." Right? The Roman says to him, "Dad, where have you been?" And he says, "It was Shabbos." Can you imagine? He says, "Shabbos? Yeah, you know, I don't answer the phone on Shabbos. I don't know." He says, "Shabbos? What do you mean Shabbos? Did you become a Jew in the other world?" says the Roman to his father. The Roman says, "Those who didn't choose to keep Shabbos in their previous life are forced to keep Shabbos in the next world." You see, this world is the opportunity to choose Shabbos, right? In the next world, we won't have a choice in the matter, and we won't have the love. In this world, because we don't have all the answers, in this world, because there is a question mark, is Shabbos so important? Is kosher really from God? That little uncertainty is why we have free choice, and that little uncertainty gives us the opportunity to do this out of love. Not because it's obvious, not because we have to, it's because we want to, because we choose to. And therefore, there's an advantage to this world that we do have a skewed picture of reality. And it's not obvious that God's Torah is true. And it's not obvious that God is present in every moment of my life. And that very lack of clarity is exactly why I have free choice in the first place. And that's what created the possibility for love. Right? In the next world, you wouldn't have a choice not to speak Lashon Hara about your friends. We wouldn't even think about speaking Lashon Hara about your friends. But is that then an act of love? Right? In the next world, you wouldn't even think about doing a kind deed for another person. Of course you do a kind deed for another person, but it won't be out of choice, because how could you not? But in this world, you got the choice. It's in this world we're able to experience love for each other and love for God. And that'll then carry over into the next world, when we'll realize that we ended up choosing what we necessarily had to do in the first place. That's really our choice in this world, to choose to be who we essentially really are, and who we discover who we are in the next world. In the next world, we'll have the peace, we'll have the clarity, we'll have all the answers, God's presence. It says that the righteous will be sitting there, and the presence of God will be so apparent, they'll just be sitting there basking in the light of godliness. It'll be that ecstasy. But those who didn't work for it, those who didn't yearn for it, those who didn't struggle with it in this world, they won't get the same experience in the next world when that truth so becomes obvious. So the truth is, there's an advantage to this world. There's an advantage to the disadvantage of not having complete clarity. And there's an advantage in the next world of having complete clarity, but there's a disadvantage of having complete clarity, because with complete clarity, I lose my free choice. But what happens in the ultimate picture of Judaism? It's called Tchiyas HaMetim. The revival of the dead is when we will ultimately experience, and I can't tell you how because I'm not being paid enough to do that, I'm just joking, I can't tell you because I don't know, but how the life after death and the life before death will be completely unified, and that will be the ultimate experience. So that's the image of death in Judaism, and that's what empowers the mourner to go on. To go on, to definitely grieve over the feeling of the loss of their loved ones, but not to grieve over thinking their loved ones are at loss over them. Because their loved ones are with them, we're in their world, even though they're not in our world. They see us, but we don't see them. And this is really critical for us to understand. Again, not that we're looking forward to death. We're not looking forward to death because we want as much time in this world of darkness to make choices out of love. There's a tremendous opportunity here. That's why when you go into a cemetery, one who's wearing tzitzit, the fringes of their garments, you have to tuck in your tzitzit so it doesn't look as if you're ridiculing the deceased over there, that they can't do mitzvahs. Because they can't do mitzvahs the way we do mitzvahs. We can do a mitzvah commandment as an act of choice. But in the next world, they're doing the mitzvahs because how could you not do Shabbos? How could you not, you know, eat kosher? How could you not put on tefillin? You know, I remember I heard a story of a friend of mine, Rabbi Shlomo Karbach, Zichro Levracha, was at his home, and they brought him a bowl of fruit, and Rav Shlomo took the banana and said, "Gavalt, brother, this banana reminds me of the Beis Hamikdash." So my friend said, "Rav Shlomo, how can a banana remind you of the Beis Hamikdash?" And Rav Shlomo said, "Friend, how can a banana not remind you of the Beis Hamikdash?" Like, Rav Shlomo was in a different world, you know. And I remember when Rav Shlomo eulogized his brother, I remember him saying, "Friends, help me, please. This is not a time to cry, because I know that my brother is in the highest world, and I know that the greatest tzaddikim have welcomed him, and that's what we have to also focus on. We have to focus not only on the grieving of the loss of our beloved, but we have to also focus on the beloved and know that they're in a good place, and know that although we're not feeling their presence perhaps in our world, some do, but very often we don't, not in the same way, even though we might not see them, they're definitely seeing us. So I'm going to unmute the phone, and you could ask some questions.
Presentation mode is on. Only organizers can be heard. Conversation mode is on. Everyone can now be heard.
Hello? Yes, go ahead.
This is Dan.
Hey, Dan.
I have two questions. One was that I, in the, in conditions in this world, I thought, as in Judaism, in the afterlife, there then follows a further reincarnation. Now, I don't know if this is talked about that much, but if that's the case, then after this state of peace that you're talking about would then follow a state of further bondage in the world, so that the cycle would continue. So that's, I'm wondering how you would put that in the perspective of what you've been talking about. And secondly, when I think about love, and that it seems to be more of a state of lack of fear, lack of doubt, it's kind of confusing to think about, but I'm not sure whether I would agree with you about the afterlife maybe is filled with love, and therefore there's no doubt, whereas in this life, when we have those few moments of love that allow us to make the choice to do mitzvahs or whatever, it might seem like it's love because of the doubt, but maybe it's really that the lack of doubt within love allows us to make those certain choices. So that's sort of a different view than the one you gave. So those are my two questions. Yeah.
Okay, well, I don't think it's a different view. Let me talk about your last question and then go to your first question. I don't think it's a different view. I think we're talking about two different aspects of love. I'm not talking about the feeling of love. I'm talking about an act of love. Right? An act of love is an act of complete freedom. When I do something for you out of a total act of freedom, I don't have to do it. In fact, there's good reasons I maybe could think of not doing it, right? I wonder whether even, you know, you deserve that I do it. It doesn't matter, I say. I choose to do this for you. Act, when you do something for the love of it, so to speak, it is an act of total freedom. Total freedom. And that total freedom comes from the fact that there are questions, there are doubts, there are reasons that one could come up with that would say, no, I'm not going to do it, but I do it anyways. I'm talking about not the feeling of love or the conscious love. Yes, I think when a person goes to the next world, they are enveloped in experiencing God's love in the most overwhelming way. But the opportunity to demonstrate love towards each other and demonstrate love to God is precisely in those difficult moments when I don't feel like doing it, and I might even have good reasons not to do it, but you know what? I rise above that and I say, you know what? I'm going to do it because I just choose to do it. You know what I mean? When is there a greater opportunity for me to show my wife love? Is it when everything's going wonderful and we agree on everything and there's no stress and there's no tension? Or when there are those moments of stress and tension and misunderstanding and miscommunication? And in that moment, that's the idea of unconditional love. When can you show unconditional love? It's only when the conditions are against love. Right? When conditions are not conducive to love and you rise above those conditions and freely choose to love somebody, whoa, that's the highest form of unconditional love. I mean, I know this is going to sound strange, but that's what the chosen people have been chosen to do. The chosen people, and this is to my mother's great honor, you know, my mother never ever shared with me, and I don't believe that she ever had a complaint against God. My mother still held on to her belief. She lived a Jewish traditional life. She lit Shabbos candles. And can you imagine a person who went through all that she went through? If anybody had a good reason to say, the hell with God, he couldn't exist, you know, she did, you know, and so did every other survivor, or, you know, they had good reasons. What an incredible show of love that although conditions so challenge your belief or your sense of God's loving presence in your life, and yet you still show your love to God. I mean, to me, that's my mother's Kiddush Hashem that earns her the next world for sure. Okay, now in terms of the reincarnation thing, the truth is, by the way, can you all mute your phones so that I don't hear background conversation, nor should anyone else hear background conversation?
Aaron, maybe you'd like to mute it when you're answering the question, because it is difficult to hear.
Okay, I shall mute.
Q&A mode is on. Participants may now unmute themselves. Presentation mode is on. Only organizers can be heard.
Okay, mutiny on the bounty. Okay, so in terms of reincarnation, it's important to understand that, yes, it's true. It is possible that my mother is not in that next world. It is possible that my mother is in my granddaughter right now. I know that's a possibility. But we go with the attitude, because we don't know otherwise, that they are in the next world. And that's the attitude we go with. It's possible that they've been reincarnated. It's possible. I don't know. But one thing we do know is that somehow that soul, on some level, is seeing you, is in your life, or actually you're in their life. And the soul is a lot broader in terms of, you know, perception. And beyond that, I don't know, because we haven't experienced it. It's impossible to describe an experience that you've never had, even though it exists. You know, I don't know what it feels like to jump out of a plane, you know, but I know the experience exists, and I certainly couldn't be the one to describe it. So I can't quite describe beyond what the sources I've had opportunity to study describe. If that was helpful, good. If not, I invite you to write me, and I'll be happy, especially with you, Dan, the man, who we've been out of touch for too long, be happy to continue dialogue with you. Any more questions?
Conversation mode is on. Everyone can now be heard.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering, this is Ilya Marcus.
Hey, brother.
Hi. I was wondering, what is the significance of that, perhaps that sour candy taste that Malachim Abbas?
Okay. Presentation mode.
Q&A mode is on. Participants may now unmute themselves. Presentation mode is on. Only organizers can be heard.
Okay. That little sour candy is the sour feeling of leaving this world. It's not as if there isn't a moment of sadness to leave this world, because we're leaving the world of choice. Now, of course, again, it's like we're leaving the world of questions and going to the world of answers. But I'm telling you, we're going to miss the questions, you know? It's like the questions also are part of life and part of the fascination and the yearning and the struggle and the consciousness. It's the questions that enable us to have a quest. So, so there is a little bitter moment. Actually, it's not little. For some people, it's horrifying, right? It's a horrifying moment. Not everybody dies in peace. My mother was blessed in her last moments to die in peace. The months before were hardly peaceful, and the week before, I felt I was, and I've never been in a concentration camp, but I felt that maybe this is a little bit of a concentration camp. The last week before my mother passed away, the pain that she went through, there were times that she would say, "Who's that over there?" I said, "Who, mommy? Who? Him, who's that?" I think she saw the angel of death. It was just days before she died. She saw somebody in the room. You know, I don't know. I don't know. So there is that moment of sourness. Some people, it'll be even more sour. You have to understand that, you know, there is a concept in Judaism of Gehenim, a hell. But that hell is also not a different planet. It's a perception. What creates the hell is ourselves. Once we get the answers, some of us will be so embarrassed when we'll finally get the answers that will be hell for us. And some of us will be so enlightened and so confirmed that what we thought and the way we lived our life was aligned with what life really is, although we were a little bit in the dark. But you know, people whose whole life revolves around their material wealth and their whole sense of self-worth is all about what everyone else will say about them, when they discover that had nothing to do with life at all, that'll be really painful. That'll be hell. And for those people who are able to enjoy their material wealth without becoming addicted to it, be concerned about peaceful relationships with others, but never basing their life on a need for everyone else's approval. And they'll discover that, yeah, you're right, that is what life was about, and you lived it right. That will be Gan Eden for them. So it's all a perception. This world, Gehenim, Olam Haba, it's all a perception. And depending on how you perceived would be life, in contrast to what you'll discover life really is, to the extent that those two perceptions will be aligned, will be your ecstasy, and to the extent that those two perceptions will be in conflict, that will be your hell. But in Jewish tradition, you won't stay in hell forever. The max is 12 months. It's a 12-month process of kind of getting over your shock and reintegrating and absorbing the true perspective on life.
Conversation mode is on. Everyone can now be heard.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Rabbi Aaron, this is Susan Ackerman. I have a question.
Sure.
It seems that in Judaism we have a lot of rules about uncleanliness and death, and we have. I think you touched on the fact that is the fact that the uncleanliness and the death has to do with, you said something about lies.
Exactly. I didn't say it. It's Rav Cook explains. Did you want to continue your question?
Yeah, well, that was kind of the question, like, why is it when we go to the cemetery, you know, everybody's so freaked out, wash their hands, and when a woman after her cycle, you know, you have to be separate from the husband, and everything has to do with this uncleanliness, that has to do with death.
Okay, good.
Q&A mode is on. Participants may now unmute themselves.
Okay, you have to understand that what I'm sharing is a perception that we're only going to be able to live with in the next world. But in this world, death looks ugly, and in this world, you cannot help but feel that something has ended, something's decaying, you know, and you have to honor that. You see, that's an interesting thing in Judaism. You know, you have to honor your perception. There is intellectual and emotionally. As much as intellectually, I can tell you the most beautiful description of my mother's death, emotionally I'm crushed, right? And I have to honor that emotion. Now, I understand that my emotion is based on a lie, right? But that's my emotion. You know, there's an interesting teaching in the Gemara that what happens if your field is flooded? Okay, so that's a terrible thing that just happened. Your field is flooded. But someone tells you that actually in the long run, this is great news, because in 2 years from now, your field is going to be doubly, triply, 10 times more fertile. So although intellectually you know that this was good, emotionally you're crushed. Your field has been flooded. So the question the Gemara asks is, what blessing should I make? Should I make a blessing, Baruch Hashem, Tovu Meiti, blessed are you, God, who is good and gives good, which is something that one should say over good news, or should I say, Baruch Dayan Emet? Should I say, blessed is he who is a true judge? Is this good, or is this bad? So intellectually it's good, but emotionally it's bad. And the halacha says you have to honor your emotion, and you have to say, Baruch Dayan Emet. And so when a person dies, we say, Baruch Dayan Emet. And we have a mourning period. I remember when I was a child, we lived in a totally non-Jewish neighborhood, and suddenly there was this huge party next door to us. And I asked my mother what's going on, and I saw all these guys showing up with cases of beer on their shoulders, and she said, well, the next door neighbor died, and they're having what they call a wake. Now, again, I don't know what exactly a wake is, but it didn't sound like mourning. They were actually celebrating, and they were drinking, and we don't do that. We do that actually the year later. We do a l'chaim to the mess, you know, but at that moment, you're devastated. You see something that is an absolute contradiction to life, and you don't want to go there. And that's what your emotional eye sees, and you have to honor that emotional eye. But you have to also honor your intellect, that your emotional eye doesn't take you to a place of despair. And that's why the halacha says that one is not allowed to start cutting themselves. You know, it's an interesting phenomena. There's this phenomena now that kids or people cut themselves. Well, there's actually a halacha that you're not allowed to cause yourself mutilation. Once upon a time, when people encountered death of beloved ones, they were so overwhelmed, they would mutilate themselves and over pain. You're not allowed to go that far. But the beautiful thing about Judaism is that it honors the emotions, because God gave you emotions. And if he gave you emotions, there's a reason for that. But he also gave you an intellect, and there's a reason for that. And you have to navigate your life between how you see things intellectually and yet how you feel things emotionally. And therefore, emotionally, I'm still in mourning, you know. And, you know, I can't listen to my Pink Floyd albums anymore. I'm just joking. But, you know, it's like I'm in mourning. But on the other hand, intellectually, what keeps me floating above it and not just going into deep despair and depression is that intellectually I know it's okay. And I intellectually I know that God runs the world and he knows what he's doing. Intellectually, but you know, what I see with my eyes doesn't always match up with what I know with my mind. And I honor that fragmentation of my life right now, because God created me that way for a reason. So yes, right now, you know, death is perceived by us as not a beautiful experience, and it's the end, it's decay, it's the loss of what can happen for this person in this world, and it is identified with impurity. The impurity is precisely this message that death is presenting us, which is a falsity, but nonetheless a falsity that I'm encountering, that even though intellectually I can say it's a falsity, but emotionally I'm still stunned. I'm still struck, and there's no reason to deny that. And that's what I think is so incredible about Judaism. It works with it, it honors it, and it creates a balance whereby we can unite, or at least bring some harmony or some working harmony between what we know intellectually but what we experience emotionally.
Presentation mode is on. Only organizers can be heard. Conversation mode is on. Everyone can now be heard.
All right, I'll take one more question if there is.
Rabbi Aaron?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Michael Ackerman. Thank you very much for that. Just very briefly, Susan and I have been blessed. He has been blessed to come learn with you and Rabbi Benny in Israel, but we're not going to be able to do that this year because we're planning a wedding in August.
All right, Mazel tov.
Thank you. But if we wanted to sponsor, you know, someone towards the learning for the program or towards the retreat, because we're not going to be there, but the learning has been so amazing, so we can't be there, but in honor of your mother, we can do that. We're going to do that on the website.
That's very kind.
So I just wanted to, in lieu of us being there.
Well, I can't even describe how my heart feels when you share that in the memory of my mother. I also want to take this opportunity, thank you for bringing that up. I do want to take the opportunity to let you all know that Israelite has a program called Inward Bound this summer, and I highly recommend it. I know the two teachers quite well. And, you know, and so it's a really life-changing experience. It's relevant and I think significant to anyone at any level of religious, observance or non-observance, you know, as long as you're mature and want to really talk about life and our purpose in life, then it'll have much value to anybody. Actually, at this moment, I forgot the exact date. Mindy, if you're there, what's the exact date?
June 25th through July 1st is the 7 days of Inward Bound, followed by an optional extended tour and explore program for 3 days.
Right.
Where we'll be touring around Masada, the Golan Heights, and some highlights of Yerushalayim, Jerusalem.
Right. Also, I've decided to start the Liba Legacy Fund in memory of my mother. And I've been overwhelmed with hundreds of condolences. It's just been an incredible healing, and anyone who wants to contribute to the memory of my mother to help me and Israelite continue our mission to share what the beauty of Judaism and the empowerment it offers us, we will welcome your investment in what we do, and my mother will love you that you're taking care of her son. Anyways, thank you so much. I really appreciate everyone connecting, and look forward to doing this again soon.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.